You're listening to The Block Experience, all things decentralized and open source. Enjoy.
Hey everyone, sorry to interrupt the podcast here. I just want to say this episode of The Block Experience is brought to you by our first sponsor, PrimeXBT. Whether you're looking to trade some of your favorite cryptocurrencies such as Bitcoin, Ethereum, and Litecoin, or even venture into other markets, PrimeXBT always has you covered. PrimeXBT offers traders access to a large variety of markets, including cryptocurrencies, stock indices, commodities, and even Forex pairs, and also have some incredible features such as anonymous accounting, Bitcoin deposits and withdrawals, industry-leading security, and even the ability to offer 1,000 times leverage. I've personally been using PrimeXBT for my trading for the past few months and have had a great experience using the platform, also using the platform's customer service. So I'm really proud that they're supporting this episode of the podcast, bringing you guys free podcasts every week. A link to the services PrimeXBT provide will be below, also a link to sign up to a new account. So thanks again, PrimeXBT, for sponsoring this episode of the podcast. And yeah, I hope you continue and like the podcast. Enjoy. Cool. Sounds good on my end.
Okay, cool.
So firstly, Eric, thanks for taking the time out of your day, obviously, to come and have a chat with me. I know things are a bit crazy right now going on in the world, so I appreciate your time at the very least. Do you want to just quickly, before we start, just tell us a little bit about yourself and maybe how you got interested in, what was like your first introduction into crypto?
Yeah, absolutely. First of all, thanks for having me. You know, we've kind of talked online in the past, but I'm excited to finally join you on the podcast and have a talk. Yeah, I actually initially got involved kind of like I feel like a lot of people did with, you know, discovering Bitcoin and kind of reading the white paper and just being fascinated by it. And, you know, at the time I was working in the financial industry, I have a bit of a trading background, like stock trading and stuff like that back in the day. So I kind of just dove in, bought it, and you know, started day trading it, you know, learned my lesson when it came to leverage and getting wrecked on certain trades and stuff like that. And eventually the day trading got a little bit too much for me. I was in some like IRC chats with people I had become friends with who were talking about Bitcoin and trading and all that. And around that time, Vitalik was giving his first public speaking engagement about this idea of Ethereum. And I just became fascinated with it. I set out with a couple friends in that group to build a decentralized exchange in 2014, which was super early, called EtherX. From then I just kind of went all in on Ethereum. I kind of, you know, left Bitcoin behind me. I still appreciate it. And, you know, they're doing good things with Bitcoin. But since then I've been kind of all in on Ethereum. And, you know, about a year and a half ago or so, I launched ETHUB with Anthony. So we've got like our docs and podcasts and newsletter. And I'm currently working at Gnosis on the product teams there.
Yeah, I've talked to like a lot of people on this podcast who like, obviously, Ethereum, like core, like they love Ethereum at their main core. And it seems like a lot of people, when they get into this space, they obviously find out about Bitcoin first. And then once they realize like the scalability and like the solutions you can build on Ethereum, a lot of people start to like realize that there's a lot more than just like a payment system and there's a lot more things that can be done. So I think a lot of people like start converting over to Ethereum and getting interested in other blockchains, not just Ethereum itself. But I think once people break away from that, Bitcoin is just like a payment system or a store of value. There's so much more you can do with the space in general, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. I kind of had this like aha moment where, you know, I was fascinated by the concept of Bitcoin, but I was kind of more fascinated with this concept of blockchain and like what it could enable. And I had this aha moment kind of watching Vitalik talk about Ethereum and this idea I hadn't heard of at the time. And just kind of like, you know, he laid out all these different use cases you could do. And just because it's a general scripting language, anybody can build anything, you know, and being kind of trader at the time, and a lot of people had just lost coins and like the Gox hack and stuff like that. Just this idea of like, you know, it was very early on and DeFi wasn't really a term yet, but you could kind of envision it in the future, and that just sent me down the rabbit hole.
Yeah, I like it. What would you say your role is within like the Ethereum community? Like, are you linked to the actual like do you do any Ethereum like development work, or would you say your role is more like community based with things like EtherHub?
Yeah, so it's kind of funny. Like, I never thought I would fall into this role that I kind of have in the community. And I guess going back, like, I started in the community on Reddit, like on the Ethereum Reddit, subreddit, ETH Trader back in the day. And that was kind of like where people would meet and talk. And then Twitter kind of got popular. I actually didn't hop onto Twitter, crypto Twitter at least, until about 2 years ago or so. But I was always trying, so I'm not a dev. I'm definitely not sitting here writing code or anything, but there was this weird thing early on in Ethereum where there were a lot of us like believers, investors, community members that didn't really have a perfect fit in the space because it was like so dev heavy at the time. Mm-hmm. At the time I was doing product management for a company outside of the crypto space, a financial software company. And there just weren't these roles in the space, and it's evolved a lot since then. But you know, for now, I never really thought I would launch like ETHUB and a podcast and a documentation mm-hmm. site and kind of had this large following on Twitter. But at the same time, my day job at Gnosis is technically product researcher. So we've been launching a lot of stuff. We just launched Gnosis Protocol. We have our Gnosis Safe Multisig out there. So I'm still on the product side of things on a day-to-day basis. But yeah, I never really thought I would fall into this kind of like community, whatever, I don't even know what you want to call it, but this community lead in a way, small lead in the community. But yeah, it's been fun.
I think a lot of people obviously want to get involved in Ethereum, and I know a lot of it's quite technical, but it just goes to show that if you really want to like just get involved in the space, like you can launch any type of like service or product that helps people or educates people. And I think especially on Ethereum, I think education is like crucial for like new people to be onboarded, you know? Because I think when a lot of people hear the words like smart contract or, you know, stuff like that, they get quite maybe turned off by it if they're not familiar with blockchain itself. And I think education is like pretty much the most important thing we can do right now to get people onboarded, you know?
Yeah, 100% agree. And that's kind of, it's funny, like ETHUB, the idea kind of started actually with like, back in 2018 or so, there was a lot of FUD being spread about Ethereum, and Anthony and I were just getting upset about it. It was just going to be like this FAQ site where like the most common FUD you see on Twitter, it like actually just replies to that and it gives the actual response of why like the FUD being spread isn't true. And then it just evolved into this education site. And I totally agree. We were thinking basically what you were just saying, like it's very intimidating to get in the space. I mean, it's still hard to translate to family and friends, like what Ethereum actually is, right? Mm-hmm. So that was kind of the goal. And I agree with you. Like I see a lot of people thinking maybe they can't get involved in this space because they don't have a technical background. Mm-hmm. But I think I would suggest that anybody that wants to get involved, just go create content, whatever it is, you know, start a podcast, mm-hmm. start writing Medium articles, get on Twitter and help people understand things. Just kind of find your niche because you can definitely capture it. That's for sure.
Yeah. Cause like if you wanted to like, for example, get somebody on board with Bitcoin, you could just say like it's a payment system, decentralized, and then that's pretty much it, right?
Yeah.
With Ethereum, there's a lot more to it, and I think that technical explanation needs to be broken down to get through the barriers, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I've been living and breathing this for 6 years now, and I still struggle to like just break it. If someone like asks me and hasn't heard of it in person, like, you know, you start saying things that don't make sense to people. I think we're getting there with better narratives, but I think the best way to show people Ethereum is just kind of the dApps that are being built. And for now, like DeFi and explaining that. But yeah, it's definitely, we still need more educational resources and stuff like that. Just to have places to direct people to go and learn about this, because they aren't easy concepts.
For sure. So obviously you mentioned the DeFi. So like DeFi has been huge, like especially like the last year. The growth on DeFi has been pretty much parabolic, and like a lot of people have been referencing that it's like a real main use case for Ethereum now. What's your opinions on that? Do you think it like stays a main use case for Ethereum, or how do you see it progressing? Because the growth has been pretty amazing.
Yeah, I think it will. I mean, even if you go back and kind of reread, you know, the white paper that Vitalik initially put out, like a lot of the, I mean, there's ideas of like DAOs in there and stuff, but a lot of the tone of the paper is pretty much talking about what eventually kind of became DeFi, right? People spinning up their own economies and tokens and indexes and all this stuff. So, you know, I think it took Ethereum a while. We kind of went through this weird phase of like the world computer meme and, you know, Web3, but we're not there as far as infrastructure goes yet. So I think DeFi is perfect product market fit right now because relatively it's low transaction count, higher wealth transactions. So you're not like like a CryptoKitties or whatever, a decentralized Twitter, which would require millions of transactions a day, right? I think eventually we'll get there, but DeFi is definitely here to stay. I think where I'll be most interested to watch this play out is, I actually am not of the opinion that it's going to just like usurp and take over the traditional finance system. I actually think it's going to kind of run in parallel for many years. Maybe eventually the traditional side will find some benefits and incorporate some things, but I think we're going to kind of have these two parallel worlds for a while.
Did you see this week, I saw it on Twitter somewhere, that Visa did a patent for a Ethereum-based smart contract card or something?
Yep.
That was pretty cool.
I did see that.
That was really cool.
It's cool to see, like, pretty much anytime you see like a patent or a larger company talking about blockchain these days, they mention it. They mention Ethereum, right? And now, like, a patent isn't guaranteed that they're going to build it by any means. But you know, Visa is dedicating resources to understanding and learning about Ethereum. Like, that's a bullish sign if there ever was one, in my opinion.
Yeah, and when I actually posted that patent, and a lot of the response I had was like, "This takes away from like the point of decentralized finance because." There's like this gap I see between, like, obviously you've got Visa, right? They profit off people, which is one of the main reasons maybe people get into decentralization and blockchain, because they're fed up of like the government controlling their funds or profiting off them. But there has to be sort of this middle gap between, there has to be like some sort of leeway, you know, so we can get through the adoption. It can't just be completely cut off from financial services, I guess.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. And I think we need to accept that there's going to be this transition period that you're kind of talking about here. Like, and you know what, like, maybe this technology will eventually make these centralized services that are like sharing your data and all that, maybe eventually it'll make those better. Like, you got to start somewhere, right? It seems clear to me that larger companies in the rest of the world are catching on to this idea of stable coins and putting US dollars on chain and seeing benefits of that. And I think that's going to be the first real big adoption wave that we see when it comes to DeFi.
Obviously, if we want to see like this growth with like banking the unbanked and stuff like that, how do you think banks will react to that? Like, obviously, do you think they'll sort of onboard over time, or do you think like it'll be more of like them trying to push us out and trying to launch some type of their own token, you know, on Ethereum?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, especially with the world financial landscape right now, right? Mm-hmm. With rates so low, rates negative in some worlds, banks are very squeezed for margin. I actually, this might be a controversial opinion in this space, but I actually don't think banks are going to be pushed back too hard on DeFi. If anything, maybe they'll see, hey, it's a lot easier for us to reach across the whole world in an instant, which is hard for them to do now. Some of the fees are lower on these things. You could see them, rather than fighting it, maybe adopt some of the benefits. I mean, they're not going to go, they have to do you know, regulations and KYC and all that stuff, so they can't just go full DeFi, obviously. But you know, this idea of, hey, I could send $100 to anyone in the world for a couple cents, although, you know, gas fees are pretty high right now, so it might be a little bit higher than that. But I think they might actually be more open to it than people think.
Yeah, I completely agree. And also, one of the things, like, especially in the UK, there's like a lot of these smaller like companies that are like banks, which are like are very UX and UI heavy. And like they target audiences around like 20 to like 25, and they have a lot of options, which we see like sort of in DeFi, like really low transaction rates, like free spending abroad. And I think a lot of these like newer banks which are coming up, not like the traditional like Wells Fargo, I think that is where maybe we could start to integrate a few options for like cryptocurrency purchases and stuff, you know?
Yeah, that's a really good point. I mean, you're seeing like a technical shift in the banking industry, like you're saying, and like even something like a Robinhood, right, is kind of like putting a big shift in like how people trade stocks, like fractional shares and stuff like that. Yeah, I totally agree. That's probably where it's going to happen first as far as adoption. Like, you know, for us to expect a Wells Fargo, JP Morgan, although JP Morgan is looking into Ethereum in a way, but it's going to start with these more tech focused ones. And you know, what's funny is, like, I would even argue, you know, I would say 2-3 years ago, UX was a disaster on Ethereum. I would even argue some DeFi apps today have better user experience than some of the traditional banking apps that are out there.
Right. Yeah, I completely agree. What do you think is the main, like, one thing we have to overcome with DeFi to, like, start to get more adoption? I think it's personally, like, UI and UX. Because it's it is, even though it has improved over like the last year, it is quite technical still with like your keys and your, you know, I think that could be improved quite heavily.
Yeah, I agree. While the UX of the apps themselves, once you're onboarded, it might be good, the getting people onboarded is still the biggest hurdle. And I would actually argue that the fee market and like how fees currently work on Ethereum is probably Ethereum's number one biggest hurdle for adoption. I mean, people don't want to understand how fees work, set a price in MetaMask. Like, this is just not a way to get mass adoption, right? So I think innovation in the smart contract wallet space, so like allowing people to relay transactions so you don't technically need ETH in your wallet, like it's being paid underneath, but you could pay the transaction fee and DAI. And improvements to the fee protocol, like EIP-1559, which I'm a big proponent of, and that's going to be an ETH2 as well, just to kind of like further improve this fee aspect to Ethereum. Because I agree with you, like the whole onboarding aspect, you sit someone down and show them the DeFi product and they like it. Now they have to go to Coinbase, they have to buy ETH, they have to set up a wallet, they have to worry about their keys, they've got to understand gas. So like there's 20 steps before they can even get to that. And we've got to make that better.
Do you reckon there's anybody that actually goes from not knowing about Ethereum one day to the next day being into a DeFi service? It's probably unlikely, right? Like most people who are using DeFi services on Ethereum probably already have been in the space for like a year, right?
Yeah, I think so. I think it'd be very rare for someone. I think maybe like, you know, DYDX just launched the perpetual Bitcoin trading. Right. Like maybe you're going to get some people that haven't been fully in DeFi going straight to that, but I don't think we're there yet. But it's a good point, right? Like that is where we need to get, because we can, it's still a niche community and industry. We can't just rely on ourselves being the ones dogfooding these products. I think the team maybe closest to that is Dharma. So Dharma's doing like very easy onboarding. Basically, to me, it looks like they're trying to be a Venmo, but paying users interest, because they take the funds and lend them out on Compound. But you know, if you look at their website or app, they basically don't even mention Ethereum or blockchain, which I think is what we need to get to.
And I think a lot of these services are sort of in that that testing development stage where we're using it currently, people who have knowledge with like blockchain and like decentralization, and we're finding bugs in the system right now. Like for example, the MakerDAO thing, which happened, I don't know when it was, a month ago or 2 months ago. Like things like that have to be ironed out before maybe we should be heading towards more like general public adoption, you know?
Oh yeah, totally. Yeah, the Maker thing with the auctions, right, there's a lot to still flesh out before we kind of onboard millions of people and more people get angry when this stuff's found. I actually think it's fine to do kind of a slow growth here when it comes to DeFi and let us early adopters hash some stuff out. I also think what's really going to be needed to push DeFi to the next level is better insurance options. Most people are used to having insurance in their bank accounts and things like that where they store their funds. We're starting to see some stuff like a Nexus Mutual pop up, but I think DeFi apps are pretty much going to have to start offering this stuff by default for people to really feel comfortable with a lot of funds in there.
Yeah, I completely agree. Apart from DeFi, what other things are you excited to see like grow on Ethereum over the next few years? I know gaming's quite popular with like the ERC-20 like purchasables and items, but what else are you excited for?
Yeah, a couple. You mentioned gaming's one. That's one I've always like. It just seems like such good potential product market fit. You know, people spend hours and spend a ton of money on games, and they don't actually really own those in-game items, but a lot of them have value. It seems perfect for like tokenization of those. I think we might run into a little bit of, I'm sure some of the bigger gaming companies might not be too down with that. They want to hold their monopoly when it comes to those items, but maybe on the indie game side. But one unique area in space I'm watching a lot recently, and I wasn't into this at all until a few months back, but Zora and like this idea of limited product drops. So basically artists create like 20, 50, 100 limited goods, and they drop them and sell them on a bonding curve on Uniswap. So like the earlier you get in, the cheaper they are. This is pretty cool because it allows artists to capture the true value of their good. Zora kind of talks on their intro blog about the Yeezy problem, where Kanye sells Yeezys, I guess, at retail for like $200, but then there's a secondary market where they sell for $900. He's losing out on that margin. So this is one area I think seems like this could get pretty big. They've only done, Zora's only done like two of these. And then of course we have Unisox as well, which is similar, but I'm keeping an eye on that area.
There's also, I can't really remember what the brand was, but it was a high-end fashion brand, and it actually already integrated Ethereum into like a, into a chip into the clothes where you can verify it's an authentic brand.
I saw that.
That was a while ago, but that was pretty cool. I think that market's going to be quite large.
Totally. I really agree. And then you kind of, with the NFT tagging, you get into like selling physical goods on chain and having tags in them. I think that whole area is probably going to take a couple years to build out, but to me, there's clearly something there.
For sure. What's your opinions on, obviously a big talking point right now is Ethereum 2.0. Phase zero rolls out in a few months, I guess. I'm not sure when Q3 or Q4. How do you think that's going to affect Ethereum?
Yeah, I mean, this is something I've been wanting since the beginning, like kind of initially getting into Ethereum. One of the biggest pitches to me was this idea of proof of stake. I'm a big fan of proof of stake over proof of work. I mean, I think we'll have one dominant proof of work chain and one dominant proof of stake chain over time, but I personally prefer the proof of stake side. So I'm excited to see this coming to fruition finally. We're getting close. I mean, so I guess it's important to understand the phases. So you mentioned phase zero. Phase zero is pretty limited. So it's just the launch of the Beacon chain and staking. So if you send your ETH over through the deposit contract, as long as phase zero is still live and we're not on the phase one or two, your ETH is just stuck there for staking.
Also, if I remember, once you send your funds to the staking for phase zero, there isn't a back way, there isn't a route back to get your funds back onto the previous chain, if I'm correct.
That's correct. Yep. So there's talks about a bridge come phase one. For early on, you're pretty much stuck over there just staking. Now, the benefits to that, right, is that how the staking rewards work, it's on a curve, and the less people staking, the higher the interest received for those staking. So you could now, after like phase two or so, I expect maybe 10 to 20 million, maybe 30 million ETH staked, which will put the rewards for validators around like 3 to 5% APR. But I think we'll see way less than that in phase zero. So like the returns to those that do take this early risk could be as high as, 10 to 15%, but we're getting close. I mean, I'm personally running on the Pry Labs testnet called Topaz. I'm running a bunch of validators to test it out. Pretty much all that's left is making a multi-client testnet stable. We have one now, there's four clients on it, but it forked the other day due to some consensus issues. So there's still bugs to be hashed out. And then I think just like 2 months of stability for the multi-client testnet. And then, the client teams will audit their own clients and then we're pretty much good to go.
What's the, like, I'm not very familiar with how you stake or the Topaz stuff. How was that to set up and like how do you find it?
Yeah, it's actually been a lot smoother than I thought. I also went super aggressive because I wanted to stress test it. I fired up 1,000 validators. So that required me having 32,000 testnet ETH, which the Pry Labs team gave me. So that made it easy on me. So there's a couple ways. I would actually suggest people that are planning to do it just personally to check out Dappnode. They're a software it's a Linux-based distribution that makes running Ethereum nodes easy. And they have an ETH2 validator on there now. So if you have a dApp node, it's honestly as easy as like three button clicks and then you're up and running. As far as running it on a base OS, which I'm running mine on Mac OS right now, even though I do have a dApp node on the side messing with that, but it's like three or four lines in command line, which is intimidating to people. But the EF also recently announced at Ethereal this thing called Launchpad, which is like a user interface for people to walk through to get their deposit over to the chain and start validating. So, I think the UX will be in a decent place come phase zero launch. I'm sure there'll be a lot more to do. But as far as like resources on my machine and stuff and like crashes, it's been very smooth.
Oh, wow. Would you like run it on like a normal PC, like your own personal PC, or would you like recommend buying sort of like a smaller like CPU rig?
Yeah, so it's interesting. Like if you go back like a year or two ago, people were expecting the resource requirements to be really high, and they've come down a lot, which is great. I'm personally running on a Mac Mini, a 2018 Mac Mini. So it's not like server grade or anything, but it's a decent machine. The only reason I'm doing that is, I'm kind of a Mac fanboy to begin with. So it's like a good machine for me. But as the phases go along, the requirements will go up a little bit. But I saw the other day that Preston Van Loon from the PryLabs team has it running. I think he's even running 100 validators on a Raspberry Pi 4. So you don't need much. So if you're looking to take to run a couple validators, it seems like that's going to be possible on something as small as a Raspberry Pi.
I think I saw, I read it this morning, didn't Hudson put out an article on his website about like something for under $700, which does the same thing?
Yeah, he did. So he was using the Dapnode, which I brought up. So Dapnode, yeah, like, is by nature software, but they sell their own hardware that comes like pre-installed and stuff. So he got, actually, you know what? He, I believe, built a mini PC.
Right, yeah, he did.
Yeah. But yeah, there's a lot of options out there, and it's not going to cost much to run your own, which is great for decentralization, right? Because we definitely don't want stake decentralized on exchanges.
Right. And what was the, would you say it's like, how are the rewards on it? I'm guessing it's more for like people who are just like committed to Ethereum and just are doing it to get their feet wet and not really reward heavy. Is that correct?
Correct. Yeah, there's not, well, technically I'm getting rewarded in testnet ETH, but okay, since that has no value, it's just exactly like you said. What I'm seeing is people just using this to start setting up their hardware and test it out, see how their setups are going to work, you know, and at the same time giving feedback to the team. So the nice thing is, because people are doing this, you know, it's easier to find bugs and you know, a lot of eyes on the software, which is good.
What are some of the main, like, obviously you maybe have a bit more familiarity with this, but what are some of the main like things devs are looking at, as in like terms of things that could delay us in ETH 2.0 rollout? Is there anything like that hasn't been like sort of ironed out already, or is there anything to be concerned about? Or
yeah, I would say the big, so phase zero is pretty much set. The spec's frozen. Yeah. We're going to be moving there. I think the big questions still after that, and I know these are things that researchers are constantly working on, so I'm not as tuned in as I probably always should be, but the big ones are going to be transitioning ETH1 into ETH2, right? So the latest I saw there was a proposal by Vitalik to basically just put ETH1 in a shard on ETH2 and what's going to be called phase 1.5. But you know, that's a pretty decent task, but it seems to be that we've kind of come to a consensus on how to handle that. The other big one will be this bridge that I mentioned. What phase does that go in? How does that look? And then I say, to me, if I had to pick like a concern around ETH2, it would be this idea of who's going to store historical state. So we're moving to a stateless client approach. ETH1's probably going to move there as well with ETH1X efforts. Basically, today to run a node, you know, you have to download something like 300 gigabytes of data to your hard drive. We're going to shift to a stateless client approach. Now, this brings up the question of, you know, we still do want people to store historical state, but if we're talking eventually 64 shards and a lot of data, that's going to be terabytes worth of data. Who's going to store that? How do we make sure it doesn't get centralized? You know, how are those teams storing that, or people storing that, going to be incentivized to do that? I think that's probably still the big question when it comes to ETH2.
Yeah, I like that. What? So like, I'm not sure if you're really tactical to answer this question, but like, a lot of how do you say it? Like, over the past like few like years, obviously we've seen a lot of like people, or not people, but like companies try and like target against Ethereum and like try and outrun Ethereum in terms of like transaction speeds, and try and say like they're technically ETH killers. Obviously no company has come close to that, right? Like Ethereum's development community is like so large, like I think that's the main reason why other networks can't really compete, just solely because of the community and the developer community. When we roll out ETH 2.0, I think there's like pretty much no reason, like there should be no technical reason, like another blockchain can't catch up with us, right? Or with Ethereum.
Yeah, so I guess first on the ETH killers, I like to call them ETH attempted murderers now, because they've failed, in my opinion. I think it's a little too late. I mean, it's never too late, technically. I'm at least not seeing the threat out there. I mean, if you look at the usage on these chains. Like Bitcoin and Ethereum are so far ahead in fees taken and activity. Like most of the chains literally have zero transactions besides just their staking transactions, right? So, and your point is interesting. Like all these teams and projects tout transactions per second and better tech or whatever. I don't think people really care. That's not what it's about at this point. I think right now this is more about building out a community, a knowledge base, developer tools, developers, like you mentioned. You know, we don't really have the demand for 100,000 transactions per second right now. Yeah, it'd be great, but like, why do we even need that? We don't yet. Well, I think
that was one of the main reasons why. So obviously, I'm pretty sure Vitalik posted or put out in an interview that he was limiting the amount of scalability or the transaction speeds. A lot of people, let's say from like the general community, not the Ethereum community, took that in a negative way, saying like, why is it so slow? Was blah, 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 blah. But Vitalik knows like, we don't need that type of like scalability right now to handle that many transactions. So what's the point of doing it? Because it'll just slow down the network.
Yeah, absolutely.
So we just wait until we need more and then we just ramp it up again, you know?
Yep, exactly. And like we're starting to see optimistic roll-ups, like Synthetix Exchange was messing with layer two solution the other day. We're starting to see options come online. I think they'll hopefully come online at the right time. Like obviously gas prices today suck. So I hope we're starting to see this. But one of the things that people don't talk about is the actual scaling bottleneck is around state size and state growth. You know, Ethereum could try to do a million transactions per second, but the state is going to get out of control, right? So it's funny to watch these teams tout transactions per second when actually kind of hiding the true issue that's behind that. And, you know, ETH2's answer and eventually ETH1 is going to be to go to the stateless client approach, which I mentioned, you know, has its own challenges as well, if we're being honest. But yeah, the scalability bottleneck is not, it all comes down to state growth.
And these, like Ethereum attempted murders, like you said, who say they have like much higher transactions, like the only reason they have higher transactions is because they give up decentralization. It's because they're centralized.
Yeah, exactly. If you look at their like block explorers, they have like five nodes. They're running pretty much all of them and they're all on servers. You know, and I'm sure some of these teams are putting out good tech and, you know, but at the end of the day, they're just kind of missing the point. And I think where they're really missing the point is a lot of them are heavily VC funded. The VCs are going to own a lot of the early distribution. They're kind of just looking for alpha. I don't think they actually believe in the projects. You know, a lot of people say Bitcoin like is this immaculate conception. I think Ethereum had like the only possible immaculate ICO or token sale, if you want to call it. It was just kind of this like perfect wave of not many people knew about it. So like people were able to get in without VCs and large whales buying up chunks. And then we had this 5 or 6 year proof of work phase, which helped distribute the coins down before we switched to proof of stake. I'm not sure anybody's going to be able to replicate it, mainly because of that distribution issue.
Yeah, I completely agree. And there's like, so there's like these three key points, right? So you got decentralization, scalability, and privacy, I think.
Yeah.
I'm not too sure. And Ethereum, when it upgrades to ETH 2.0, will have all three compared to the Ethereum attempted murders who just have transaction speeds and no decentralization or privacy. But yeah, it's definitely interesting. It is,
and it's funny. Like we've seen plenty of times in the crypto space, like chains or products just sit around, and like the tokens are still traded, but nothing's actually happening on them. So I don't know what the end game is going to be here, but it'll be interesting to watch.
Amazing. Do you want to just quickly shout out to where people can find you, or the projects you're working on, or Ethereum, for example?
Yeah, the best place to find me is on Twitter, just at econoar, so econoar. ETHUB's at ethub.io. We do a weekly newsletter that you can subscribe to. We put out two podcasts a week. And then also, you know, I mentioned earlier, I work for Gnosis, so definitely go check out the Gnosis Safe if you're into wallets. We have the Gnosis Protocol out now and a lot of other good stuff. So yeah, but just come find me on Twitter. I'm always down to talk.
Amazing.